Welcome to Louisiana Lefty, a podcast about politics and community in Louisiana, where we make the case that the health of the state requires a strong progressive movement fueled by the critical work of organizing on the ground. Our goal is to democratize information, demystify party politics, and empower you to join the mission, because victory for Louisiana requires you. I'm your host, Linda Woolard. On this episode, I speak with Representative Amy Adato Freeman from Louisiana House District 98. We talk about how she successfully passed a sales tax exemption for what's been called the pink tax, because it unfairly taxes necessary items that women buy regularly, namely feminine hygiene products and diapers. That's a particularly discriminatory tax when you consider that women are routinely paid less than men. Representative Freeman also shares some insight on how to build needed majorities to pass bills and the important role our progressive advocate groups play in informing legislation. Representative Amy Adato Freeman, thank you so much for joining me on Louisiana Lefty today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I always start the podcast with how I know my guest, and I suspect we connected through the Independent Women's Organization, or IWO. Does that sound right to you?
That does sound right. I think you were either president or incoming president or outgoing. I know you were in leadership at IWO when I first met you.
Well, that sounds right to me, because that's where I feel like I remember you most from. You're actually my representative in District 98 in Louisiana, in the Louisiana legislature. I want you to know that you sent me a handwritten note when you were running for that seat. And I still have that because it meant a lot to me. And you acknowledged in the note that you knew I actually had a different candidate, but that you wanted to reach out because you wanted me to keep you in mind for future support. And that was a really powerful thing for me. It was a very powerful message that you sent. And I was so impressed by it, like I said, that I've kept that note.
That makes me happy. That makes me smile. Okay. I do like to write notes. It's kind of something I've done my whole life.
Well, I mean, and not only did you reach out to me in that moment, you've always treated me like a valued constituent. And I think that should really be a model for other candidates and elected officials. So I just wanted to mention that, give you that shout out.
Oh, I appreciate that, Linda, because for me, I feel like, you know, even if someone was not a supporter of mine, now that I'm in the role, I represent them, right? Oh, believe it or not, in this district that I'm representing, we even have some very far right Republicans. I do not vote the way that they ask me to. I still talk to them. I still take their calls. I still call them back, because I think if someone's engaged in the process, that's part of what you do when you're up there and representing the whole district. So.
I think that's right. So what's your political origin story? What first got you interested in politics?
Probably my parents, because they've always been engaged in the community. My mom specifically has always been engaged in the community. And she's a lifelong Democrat who would host receptions at the house for candidates she thought would be good for changing the landscape of New Orleans. And she grew up in Thibodaux, Louisiana. But she came here and she just saw a lot of need to help. And so you know, she actually, if you ever ask Oliver Thomas about Bibi Adato, he will say, she lady in the Garden District who hosted receptions for people like me, you know, that people wouldn't open their doors at that time, which is sad to think that that was happening when I was a kid. But my mom was a very open-minded person and saw somebody who was going to be a good leader and was willing to do that. So I'd give my mom a ton of credit for putting me into the realm of public service in general. And then when I finally got to this decision to run for office, the only thing I ever give Trump credit for is motivating me to put my name on a ballot.
I think he had that effect on a lot of women.
I had the time. My younger daughter was still in high school, and I remember, you know, she was boohooing on the bed upstairs. She couldn't vote yet. She was still a junior, and like sitting on the bed with her while she's crying. And the daughter, who is out of the house and now married, but at the time she was still single, her calling, and they were crying. And it didn't come to that decision that particular night. But I did come to it relatively quickly in the sense that I thought, you know, if not me, who? And if not now, when? Honestly, I thought about running for city council first and then realized that the policy changes that I cared the most about happened at the state level. And, you know, I'm a business strategist. That's what I do for my living. And what I do with my clients is help them figure out how to grow their businesses. And so I kind of whiteboarded myself, you know, and looked at where could I do the best work. And so that's kind of my short version of my political journey. You know, ran in a very contested race. There were seven of us. And the year I ran, 2019, it was the busiest race of all the legislative races. So it was a tough race. And then, you know, got sworn in. And then shortly afterwards, we were in the middle of an international pandemic. So I don't think any of the freshman class up there thought that's what we were getting into. But there's 44 people in that freshman class. And I will give COVID the credit of, because we were in the Capitol with restrictions, one of the benefits was that we got to know each other more personally, because we didn't have a bunch of people in the building at the time. People could come in, but very people were. And you really couldn't talk to people too closely, because I personally was trying to keep my distances and wear my double masks and all those things. But we did get to know each other personally. I think it was a big help, especially when we get into negotiating things. Any new work environment, getting to know your colleagues makes a difference in your success in a work environment. And I see, you know, obviously I don't agree with everything that people are doing in my freshman class, but there are people that I've come together with on things that I might not have if I hadn't gotten to know them a little bit on the personal side.
And tell me a little bit of your mini bio of really what prepared you for this moment where you entered politics. What sort of have been the things that you've done that have prepared you?
One is just my approach to how I work in business with my clients. We go through a process where I talk to the business owners or the senior decision makers, and I do a lot of listening. So I figure out what their biggest stressors are and then help them build realistic growth goals for their companies. I'll use an architecture firm as an example. The architect clients I have, you know, they can design the most fabulous buildings and they can win these amazing awards, but sometimes they need somebody like me to help them focus on which buildings win awards and also are profitable to growing your business. So coming into legislature, the listening skills I have are really strong. And so I do a lot of listening, and not just, you know, to the constituents, obviously, but also to my colleagues who have different viewpoints than me. And sometimes I vastly disagree with them, but I believe the listening skills are critical if I can just sometimes hear their perspective. It does mean that I sometimes, as a Democrat, I'm biting my tongue because they're saying things to me that I'm thinking, I can't believe this person thinks this way, but it gives me some perspective. So that, you know, the listening and the business experience I have, but I would also give a lot of credit to the fact that I raised four children, and they're all ages. The oldest is 33 now, the baby will be 21 in January. So with the support of my husband and my four kids, but the raising of kids teaches you a lot of things about life. So I've learned a lot of things about life and how to approach things and when something is an emergency and when something's not an emergency from being a mom. I mean, that's a big part of who I am.
Well, and I think that's a really good pivot point for us to talk about this landmark legislation you passed this year. Let's dive into what you were most eager to talk about on the podcast, which is the pink tax exemption that finally passed the legislature this year. It's taken a while.
Yes.
Can you explain what the pink tax is and then what this exemption will do?
So the pink tax exempts all menstrual products and diapers from sales tax statewide. And it comes into effect on July 1st, 2022. The genesis of this project, shall we call it that? Because, you know, sometimes you have to file a bill several times before it becomes law, began back in 2017, where my friend, former Senator J.P. Morrell, started carrying it, trying to get the statewide sales tax exemption, and many of us vastly agreed with him that this is something that shouldn't be taxed for women and families because these are essential products. You can't choose whether you buy tampons and Tampax pads.
Diapers.
And you can't really choose whether you buy diapers, whether you're taking care of an infant or you're taking care of an elderly relative or a disabled child. You need them. So we already know that we have statewide tax exemptions for medicines and things like kidney dialysis machines. So we wanted to put this in the same category. And he was not successful in 2017. He filed the bill again in 2019, again, ran up against a bunch of opposition. And because he is such a strategic thinker, after I was elected, he said, I think there's a way for us to do this locally. And he came up with the concept of me. So the very first bill that I gave local municipalities the option to take away their local taxes. So in fact, that act is over my shoulder, if you can see it on the video.
Was this last year that happened?
That was in 2020.
My freshman year.
So my freshman year, that particular bill was passed, and Orleans Parish, Shreveport, and East Baton Rouge all took advantage of the local option exemption. So, you know, if you didn't want to, you didn't have to, but if you wanted to, you did. And so my friend, Councilwoman Moreno, passed, you know, unanimously got this through our city council. And then there was a council member, Erica Green, in Baton Rouge, who did it. And I can't recall the woman who carried it in Shreveport, but they reached out to us. And so we got that into place. And so when I knew that 2021 session, which is a tax policy year, you can only do fiscal policy statewide on the odd years, HB7 was the bill I filed. I mean, I knew I was going to file it. I knew I was going to file it before I even filed the one I'd filed the year before. And so it was one of the first bills filed, and I had to walk it through the entire process. And sometimes I was carrying it with, you know, tiptoe shoes, because it was very difficult to move that bill. Some of my Republican colleagues don't like any exemptions. So they're just against like any exemption, they'll tell me. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. But as long as you're exempting things that corporate people buy, I'm asking for the women and children of Louisiana. That's who I'm here for. And, you know, I had some of them say things to me like, well, I've talked to my wife and three daughters and they don't think that we need this. I'm like, well, I'm not necessarily doing it for your wife and your three daughters. I'm doing this for people who live on the margins, the paycheck to paycheck people. Little bits of money make a big difference to their final budget. And this money is going right back into them buying groceries or something else that they need if they're not paying this tax. So it took me three times to get the bill out of Ways and Means.
So that's something J.P. Morrell never did. It never got out of committee for him, correct? So yes, how did you get it out of committee finally?
So the first time the chairman was not hearing any exemption bills. So he kind of everybody's was tabled that day, you know, so I was on the list of, and he told me, he's like, I'm tabling your bill. The second time I was one vote away from getting it out of committee because they had the objectors. And sadly, one of my Democratic colleagues was not in her seat. And so I lost by a vote. The third time I went before the Democratic caucus, who went to the speaker, and my bill became part of the Democratic caucus package. And so that time it got out without opposition because I had the chairman's support, which is kind of critical on a bill like that. And he essentially told everybody in his committee that he was moving this bill to the floor. And so his support was essential to move it to the floor. And really, the advocates came up and testified with me on the second try when we were up there. And it was not a good day. I kind of stormed out of the room, very unhappy because I was one vote short of getting it out. And that's a very bad feeling when you're that close. But when it got to the, and that was kind of the story of Ways and Means. I think it took me having a lot of individual conversations with the committee members, you know, and that's a big committee. There's like 20 members or more than 20 members.
And did you, did you get Republicans on board with it in the committee?
Yeah, I had to. Well, the chairman's Republican. So without his, I mean, and I wasn't going to get all of them, but I needed enough of them. And I knew which ones I had. And honestly, there were no objections that third time. I think there were people who wanted to object, but they must have had some other bills that they wanted out of committee. So, you know, they went with the chairman and didn't bother him on that one. But I did run into more trouble when I got to the House floor, because they didn't, some of them didn't want to move it off the House floor. So they were trying to hold it at that point again.
Are there other reasons besides just not liking any exemptions? Were there any other reasons folks gave you?
Well, if we're going to exempt that, we should exempt toilet paper. If we're going to exempt that, you know, just silly. To me, Linda, they were not valid reasons, but I had to listen to them because I needed to hear their points of view, right? And honestly, once it was on the House floor, I needed 53 votes to move it, right? A lot of being a legislature, maybe it's just because I like numbers and I use them all the time in my business practice. But a lot of it's a math formula, right? If you got your 53 votes or your 70, because some votes require 70, because some votes require 2/3. But if you have your 53 votes, your bill's moving across the hall to the Senate, right? So it took me a few weeks to make sure I had those lined up. And really what I knew I had to have was the support of the speaker. Because without the support of the speaker, that bill wasn't going to move. Because there's only 35 Democrats and 2 independents. So that if I get every Democrat and my 2 independents generally go with the Democrats, but sometimes they don't, I still only had 37, right? So his support was critical. It was a critical piece to moving it.
And how'd you talk him into joining?
You know, I probably annoyed him a lot because I brought it up often. And he was so focused on the centralized sales tax, which unfortunately did not pass. And I did support it throughout the process. And it didn't pass. And it's a way for us to centralize collections. And there are other viewpoints who think it was going to hurt us. I believe it would be great for our state if we centralized collections. And I really don't see it as a partisan issue. But he was focused on that. He asked me for support on that. And, you know, so, I mean, some of it is horse trading, right? You know, yes, I will support you on this, and this is how I can help you. And, you know, and making sure that we kept it as part of the Democratic package, you know, keeping it inside of our negotiations as a whole.
You had 33 groups behind you pushing for this?
Yeah. Yes. And those people are really important to the process. Yes.
Including Right to Life. This was a real across the aisle ambition here.
Yeah. In fact, the coalition that was built around this thing, you know, to have Lift Louisiana and reproductive rights groups and the Right to Life and the Junior League and the, you know, Catholic bishops all, you know, together on this was a critical piece. Because I can tell you for sure, there were a couple of legislators who were, you know, oh, I don't think I don't need to do this, whatever. And then, you know, someone from the Junior League in their area would call them. Or Ben Clapper, who's the Right to Life representative, said, this is really important. We run diaper banks. We support this because we need, you know, a better way to run these centers, you know. So that coalition was a huge part of it. In fact, we're having a ceremonial bill signing Monday coming up with the governor so that all those advocates can get the recognition that they deserve. Because all I did was carry the piece of paper around the building and argue for it. But they're the ones who really kept it going, you know, since 2017.
Well, you know, I talk a lot about unanimous juries on this podcast and criminal justice reform, and how part of how we've made progress in Louisiana is because it is backed by folks from both sides of the aisle. There is a bipartisan effort there. There is conservative and liberal reasons to support that. So I think in Louisiana, when we're going to make progress, that's a big key to it. And that might seem like an odd thing to say on a progressive podcast, but because we are such a minority in the state, if we're not finding those opportunities where we can work together and build those unique, broad coalitions, we're just not making progress.
And I agree with you, Linda. You know, sometimes I think to myself, it's difficult for my kids who are, you know, younger and always educating me on the most progressive ways to viewpoint things. You know, I start to think, well, I'm kind of old. I didn't know that. And they have to tell me, you know, this is mom, you can't say this word anymore. Okay. I'm learning. Y'all, you know, I am a little bit older than y'all. But I tell my own kids this often. I'm like, the situation that I'm in, the way that I'm serving in this role, I have to have Republican support to move things. Otherwise, I'm just filing a bill, which is fine. And I did file the LGBTQ housing equity bill, and it got killed in committee, right? That doesn't mean I'm not going to file that bill again. But I also want to see me file some bills that become law because I built the coalition, right? Because that's just how if I want to be a good public servant, I want to serve the public and get some things done for them. So it is tricky, and it is, it's hard, especially when I'm using my own kids as an example. You know, they sometimes don't get it. Like, well, that guy said this thing and we saw it on social media. I'm like, well, I know, but that guy also will help me get me a vote. So I could get in a big argument with him, or I could just know that he and I are totally opposite on all these things, but on these other things, we can come together, you know?
That's one of those, the answer is it's complicated.
It's really complicated. And it takes a lot of relationship building. It does. It does.
Where do you put yourself on the spectrum? Do you consider yourself more moderate, more progressive?
You know, I mean, I think of myself as moderate because I like to get things done, and I have more of an independent viewpoint of life because that's just who I am. If you look at my record, you know, Republicans in my district will tell you that I'm very, very left. You know, they'll call me up and say, you voted for this, you voted for that. You know, and I have to explain to them why. But personally, I think of myself as somebody who's trying hard to get things done. So that's more of a moderate personality, which is why I need my advocates who are further to the left of me to show up and help me explain things that I'm not going to explain the right way, that I'm going to explain in a more moderate way. I need sometimes them to say, but wait, this is why we think this, and we've been working on this issue, Amy, and this is, you know, what we want to bring to the table. So they're really essential, the advocates that I work with.
Amy, how have you found ways to work with Republicans to pass the things you want to get passed?
So I do a lot of listening, like I said earlier, to their perspectives. And then I also try to put myself in their mindset. For years, I've taught a class at Tulane about business communications. And one of the things I always told my students was, if you forget me, if you forget this class, but you're in business in 15, 20 years, remember these three words: know your audience. And so I try to put myself into, like, if I'm working with the speaker, he is my audience at that moment to get on board. Like when I was working on the pandemic EBT bill, we were leaving federal funds on the table and we needed to get those money to the hungriest families in the state. I knew what I could say to the speaker in order to help get him on my side on that particular bill, because I was also working with the chairman of education, who I was not getting through to, who was not really hearing me, who did not like my bill because of privacy concerns. So that audience, at the time, the chairman of education was Ray Garofalo, he just wasn't hearing me. I mean, I was hitting a roadblock. So I knew my audience there well enough to know that I needed to go to the speaker and say, listen, you appoint your chairman, he's your chairman, this is what I know, these are the number of families that are left behind. I know that you as the speaker want to make sure these families get this money too. And so, you know, knowing your audience and knowing which pieces of your audience to go talk to, you know, obviously speaking to the people in leadership matters. They make the final decisions, right? It's just like any business, whether it's an architecture firm or an accounting firm or, you know, a restaurant, whoever is at the top of the, you know, decision-making tree is who you have to really talk to. So I do spend a lot of time talking to some of the top people, like, I knew that that LGBTQ housing bill was going to die before I even presented it in committee. But I made sure the speaker knew that I knew that and that I was going to do it anyway. You know, I'm going to file it again because I think all it does is put us into line with the federal laws that already exist to protect those individuals. And our law is in conflict with federal law, which, you know, but we still haven't fixed it. But, you know, I knew that the people on that committee would, you know, from the northern part of the state were not going to support me. They killed the bill. You know, it was like, it was terrible.
So it wasn't just a principled stand for you, which is worth taking also, but you actually believe we're not in alignment with the federal law.
We're not. We literally are not. Like, it's, I mean, and the advocates who Forum for Equality is the one who talked to me about that. That's how I, you know, learned that we weren't in line. It's a stand. Obviously, I want to make sure that people aren't discriminated against in their housing. But, you know, to have conflicting laws where you have like the federal law telling you you can't, but the Louisiana law doesn't say that, well, it needs to say it. It needs to equal. So, you know, I knew that I was going to lose that one, shall we say, in committee, because there's so many people who don't understand why that's important outside of New Orleans. Really, it's a shame. It's terrible, but it's just the truth.
So you mentioned part of what makes you successful with the legislation you bring is knowing your audience. Would you credit that as well with part of what made your campaign successful?
Probably. I think they're definitely related. A lot of my campaign was really listening. So, you know, going door to door, going to neighborhood organizations, I'm very active in my own neighborhood association for many, many years. And really knowing that people want access to whoever their elected official is, that they can talk to them, that they can bring them information. There's nothing, I mean, you're a grassroots campaigner, so you know this. I'm being at someone's doorstep is the best way to really know what matters most to them. There's nothing that beats that. No TV commercial, radio, you know, talking to them on the phone. Yeah, that's good too. So, you know, but standing on their doorstep to saying, hi, what really matters to you and how can I help you in particular issues makes a difference.
Time and time again, we see first-time candidates. I don't mean just in Louisiana, anywhere. Yeah. If they're showing up at people's doors and talking to them at their door, like you're saying, that really is a part of the secret sauce that leads to people getting elected. I'm curious, do you know how many doors you personally knocked?
Gosh,
it's a while ago now.
But no, you know, I know it's a while ago, and we had a pandemic start, and so that gosh, Linda, I should know this. I mean, you know, Wesley Bias was my canvas. He drew my list for me, and I know he's a friend of yours. He's so amazing. I adore him. He would probably know, but I mean, we were, you know, constantly cutting lists, knocking doors. I had so many amazing Tulane and Loyola students, and Ben Franklin students. Those were my top three student bodies who helped me knock door to door, and I enjoyed the door to door more than anything. Way more than, you know, forums and all that kind of stuff, because I always learned something. The students who went with me always learned something. Sometimes between houses, some of the students would, you know, brief me on some paper they were writing on some particular topic, like the environment, and, you know, they were doing research. So I would say thousands, because I pretty much walked the entire district.
I bet so. You know, yeah, I bet
you know,
so.
In some areas more than once. So,
and I think candidates would be surprised if they start early enough to know how many doors they could actually knock, how many people they could speak to.
Yeah, and in a city, it's a lot easier to do something like that. You know, if you're in a rural area, it's very different. But you know, I have my son-in-law. Who worked on Obama's ground team out in Nevada. He made me a map. He used Google Maps to screenshot the district, and it's still hanging in my office right now. And he kind of made it into a PowerPoint slide kind of thing, and we printed out. But I would come home and I would, you know, take a highlighter on the blocks that I'd been, and then I would try to figure out which one I would do next. And Wesley would help me. I loved that part of the campaign, though. I absolutely loved it. I probably, out of all the doors I knocked on, maybe had like a couple of, you know, slams, people slamming the door in my face. But that's to be expected. But right. the majority of the thousands of people I talked to were great and really wanted to talk about what mattered to them in the city and in Louisiana.
I love that. Well, we spoke in the video before we got to the podcast, the video that I'll post to Facebook, a bit about the number of women in the Louisiana legislature. Tell me again, how many are in there now?
Okay, so in the House, we have now 22, because Delisha Boyd was sworn in on Monday out of 105. And on the Senate side, there are 6 women out of 39. So out of 144 members in the legislature, there are 28 women.
Not exactly a reflective democracy.
Not at all. As far as I know, the registered voters are over 50% women in the state.
So I think that's right.
It would be nice if we could get there with women in the legislature. I will sleep happy when we see more than 50% of women in the legislature.
And not all of the women that are elected are really voting in the best interest of Louisiana women. How does that complicate some of the work you're trying to do there?
Yeah, that is a very challenging conversation, because some of these women represent very, very right Republican viewpoints. But what I can say, and I've learned this from meeting other women legislators for this women legislators group that I've become part of that's across the United States, is that we do caucus together, and not every legislator does it. Like in Georgia, the Republican women aren't allowed to caucus with the Democratic women. And I recently learned that from a friend of mine who's a new fellow in E Pluribus Unum. She's in that group. And Kim told me that. Whereas we do have a women's caucus, it's the senators and the House members together. So for example, when it comes to Title IX and all of the atrocities of LSU covering up all of those cases that happen, and the paper wrote about the football players, but they were young women who came to testify in front of us who had nothing to do with sports and had no relationship with athletes. So the Title IX problems were throughout LSU. Beth Mizell, who is the president pro tem of the Senate, and I worked very closely together on that particular piece of legislation to make sure that LSU and other public universities were held accountable if they weren't doing the right things. And that became a big women's caucus issue. And in fact, earlier this week, we had a women's caucus issue about human trafficking because there's been some hearings about that particular topic. So we can find things to come together on. I had a lot of women support me on the pink tax, but not all of them, you know? So, and just like some of my male colleagues, I'm not going to change their mind, right? And like I told you earlier, it's a formula. I need 53 votes to move something off the House floor and try to work it on the Senate side. And as long as I have 53 or 60 or 62, you know, I'm moving something. And so I can't change their viewpoints. And some of that can be frustrating when you see some women voting against what I think is best for women. But then I have to do my whole know your audience thing and think to myself, they're representing a different group than I am. So,
have you found unexpected allies from other parts of the state that aren't in one of the big cities?
Yeah, I've become pretty good friends with Rhonda Butler, who represents a rural area. She sits across from me, and not everybody knows this, but we don't have offices in the Capitol. We have our desk. You get an office if you're a chair of a committee, but otherwise your desk is your office. And so if you're trying to get something done before session starts or later in the day, you're sitting there on your laptop or whatever. But Rhonda and I, she and her husband, he's a veteran, and they run a tree recovery and cutting service. It's not just in Louisiana, but she's from a rural area, and we have become really good friends. And it's very interesting because, I mean, if you look at our voting record, she's definitely a Republican. I'm definitely a Democrat. But there are times when the two of us will watch some of the guys doing their guy things, like where they're arguing over something that makes no sense. And she'll look at me, or I'll look at her and be like, there they go again. Because they'll just, I mean, it sounds very stereotypical, but sometimes they, you know, do things that they just waste some of our time on. So she has become a good friend and a good ally. And we definitely don't see things eye to eye. You know, there are times where, you know, she's pro-life. I'm very pro-choice, you know, so, but she has a disabled child. So when I started working on this pink tax bill, she became one of my allies because she has an adult child who's always had issues his entire life. And so she knows what kind of families deal with when they have a child like that. So.
Well, that's fascinating. And I think that's the only way forward, is for us to continue to have these relationships with people who don't necessarily think the same way we think in Louisiana.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And it's hard sometimes. It doesn't make it easy. But like I said, with my four kids, I try to have these conversations with my kids. You know, my daughter and her husband who live in Denver will say things like, how did you talk to that person? You know, I don't know how you talk to that person. Well, because I need to talk to that person because we have to work together for me to get something done. You know, and I encourage you to talk to other people that have different viewpoints than you, because that's the only way forward. But it's hard. It's hard. And I do think, I hate that as a country, we're becoming more and more polarized. It kind of breaks my heart to see the polarization. And I think of my grandfather, whose family came over here from Turkey, and he grew up in Seattle. He was born in Seattle. And he was a first generation American, and he went to University of Washington, and then he was able to go to med school, and then he went to World War II. And he ended up in Louisiana because he met my grandmother, who was from here and grew up on Jefferson Avenue. But Carl Adato was his name. I think about how hard he worked and what he did to bring people together. And I think a lot of my influence from him has me thinking, like, there is a way, I can find a way to work with people that are different viewpoints.
Well, how can people connect to your work? And I'm asking you mostly as a legislator, but if you have consulting information you want to plug people into as well, please do.
Sure. I obviously, they can reach me through the legislature on my, if you go to the House website, you can just click on my picture, or, you know, look me up and you can send an email directly to me. The office number we have is 548-611-1614. So you can always call the office. If we're in, especially when we're in session, when people have comments on bills, I have a fabulous legislative assistant, Allison Cohen, and she tracks those kind of things. And we have a really good system where she can get the information. I can see it almost immediately, so I know what's happening, you know, live. So I encourage people to stay involved. I encourage people to reach out. And then on the consulting side, I do have my own website, amyfreemanconsulting.com. People can email me through that if they're a business owner. I've worked with everything from an early stage startup to, at one point, I did a lot of work with HSBC Bank, which is an international bank. And I'm always interested in helping somebody, whether it's a startup business or a business where, you know, a family has been running, trying to figure out what they're going to do with the next generation. Especially in Louisiana, I love helping my Louisiana clients because that's our future. That is our future. And we have a lot of opportunities to grow in Louisiana. But part of why I do what I do with my business side is because I care about Louisiana becoming a leader and not being 49th and 50th on everything. So.
Well, I will share links in the episode notes, as always. I want people to know, too, you have a great video about the pink tax exemption.
Yes.
And I'll put a link to that in the notes.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. And I would say, I have to give a special shout out to my legislative assistant, Allison Cohen, and the interns from Tulane who helped me create that video. It was home done. It was, you know, we didn't have technology. So they did it because it was presented at the U.S. National Conference on Poverty. And it was their opening video because it was an online conference this year.
It's a great video. It's really well done.
Yeah, they did a great job. I'm really excited that they, and it was an interesting story to be able to share so that people other places can understand that it takes multiple times. You know, it's not always your first try or your second try. You just have to keep going at something to get something moved. And that's so true. The one frustration I really have, Linda, is sometimes I think it moves slower than I want it to, but that's just the legislative process, right? And I have to accept that it doesn't always go at the speed I want it to, or that we all want it to. A lot of us want it to. So.
Well, and I have a lot that I could say about that, but I'll save that for another time.
I know.
But let me get to the last three questions.
Okay.
I always ask a version of these three questions at the end of every episode.
Okay.
What do you think the biggest obstacles for Democrats in Louisiana are?
I think the biggest obstacles are organization and candidates. Those are the two biggest things. We aren't centrally organized well, I don't think. And then we don't always enter candidates in races where we should be. So if anybody's listening wants to get involved in their own area and they've never even thought of running for office, I would say reach out to the state party, but I would also say there's so many advocacy groups now who are training people to run for office, right? And they're often doing it virtually since COVID. And some of them have kept those courses on virtual. But also reach out to other legislators. Like one of the things as the Democratic caucus, we talk about how do we become resources for future candidates. And I'm happy to talk to potential candidates. And I know a lot of my other colleagues are, but we've got to be organized and we've got to enter people. Sometimes there's some seats in Baton Rouge that have Republicans in them because no Democrat even showed up to run for the seat. And that's just disheartening in many, many levels.
Yeah, I think those are two good answers. What do you think our biggest opportunities are?
Well, because we're the minority party, that means we have lots of opportunities to grow, right? And so I would say opportunities would be, and I'm no studier, I'm not a student of the data, you know, I'm not a Wesley bias, but, you know, when you ask somebody like Wesley, they can, you know, really analyze that data. And the opportunity is to look at the data and as we redistrict, make sure that the districts where we have a group that's more, you know, potentially Democratic, enter strong candidates, find different people who can run, you know, and organize together to help those candidates. If you're not somebody who thinks they could run for office, there's always somebody that you can get behind and go knock on doors with them or make phone calls or, you know, help them create a social media presence. There's a lot of opportunity to get involved, a lot of opportunity.
I think that's well said also. Amy, who's your favorite superhero?
Oh, right. You told me you were going to ask me this question. And now I'm like, oh, who is it? My favorite superhero, gosh, I mean, I guess it's Wonder Woman. I just said it's a hard time. It's hard for it not to be Wonder Woman. You know,
she is a show favorite. We've had many guests say that she was inspirational to them. So,
yeah, I mean, as a kid, for sure. But then again, you know, it's always good to watch a little Tasmanian devil too, and he's not really a superhero, but
that's all right.
He got stuff done, Linda. You know,
I like it. There are no rules to who's your favorite superhero. You're allowed to answer however you'd like. Representative Freeman, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate all the work you're doing, and I appreciate your taking the time to speak to me about it.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Louisiana Lefty. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you to Ben Collinsworth for producing Louisiana Lefty, Jen Pack of Black Cat Studios for our Super Lefty artwork, and Thousand Dollar Car for allowing us to use their Swamp Pop Classic Security Guard as our Louisiana Lefty theme song.